Welcome to another conversation in the Neon Jazz interview series with very accomplished tenor saxophonist, composer, and educator Jerry Berganzi. On some downtime from playing and educating, Jerry reflected on a well-traveled life in the world of jazz that brought him into the Dave Brubeck orbit quite a bit and sent him around the world. He also talked about how he feels about traveling, the cats he has played with over the years, who he'd like to gig with, what is next, and how he feels about his legacy, along with much, much more. Dig it, my friends.
Hi, Joe. How you doing?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing fairly well.
Let me just go ahead and start off here. What's been going on lately?
Well, you know, I'm always on either teaching or on tour, one or the other. But the last couple of months I've been home enjoying this wonderful winter. And, you know, I go out to Kansas this week. And then the week after I'm in L.A. teaching at the Thelonious Monk Institute. Then I'm in Toronto for a week. And then I have 3 weeks finishing, doing any New England Conservatory. Then I go out for 2 weeks in Europe. It's like that. I'm out 2 weeks in May. I'm out most of June, a little bit of July. I'm supposed to go to Africa at the end of August. It's non-ending.
Yeah. Do you like traveling?
You know, at times I do. Sometimes I get tired of it. When I'm there, I like it, but the going to airports like 2 hours early and being treated like a terrorist, you know, in the 70s, you could get there 10 minutes before the flight, waltz on board, there's open seating, you know, they feed you. It's a different story, you know?
Yeah.
So, I enjoy it.
Wonderful. Let me go to your beginnings in Boston. How did Boston cultivate a love of jazz for you?
Once more, please.
How did growing up in Boston cultivate a love of jazz for you?
Well, I don't know that it was Boston. It was mostly my family. I had an uncle who lived upstairs who was a jazz musician. He played trombone, bass, and guitar. And for some reason, you know, I don't know, my first record was Lester Young with the Kansas City Seven. And, you know, so on and so forth. I just grew up listening to jazz. And grew up in Watertown, which was a bus ride to take lessons at Berklee School of Music when I was in high school. I studied with Joan Viola, and I was in John LaPorta's youth band. So, yeah, it was just, I had, you know, I didn't realize how lucky I was at the time, but and we had a great jazz workshop where all the heavies were, you know, Miles Davis's, John Coltrane's, Art Blakey's, different groups, and Cannonball, you know, Sonny Rollins. Everybody would come to the jazz workshop in Boston. Actually, Sonny Rollins was infrequently, but the other ones were very frequent. Yeah. So I got to see all these great musicians. And we had another one north of the city called Lenny's on the Turnpike, who also had great jazz coming in all the time. So I got a chance to see a lot of great players.
Right on. So then you made your way to New York in 72. What was that first year in New York like for you when you finally got there and you started playing? What was that like for you?
Well, you know, I moved in with a bass player, Harvey Swartz, and he, somebody would call him and ask him to do a gig. Oh, you need a tenor player? You need a tenor player? We'd be playing sessions all the time. But it was slow work-wise. But then things started to pick up. I had a gig at the Mercer Art Center every weekend with Sam Burtis on trombone, Harvey Swartz on bass, Chip White on drums, and that went on for a while. So actually the roof of the building caved in, so we didn't do that anymore. Then I got a call from Darius Brubeck, and he said, you want to go on the road with my group, because I'm going to tour with my father, and he said they're going to be two groups. We'll open up, then Dave will come on and play, then we'll do 3 or 4 encores together. So that just kind of worked out. I was lucky to get that gig, and that's how I could stay in New York and pay the rent and do all that jazz.
Sure. So what was the first meeting like when you met Dave Brubeck the first time?
It was very casual. You know, big thing. You know, because his sons used to call him Uncle Dave. They used to call him UD, Uncle Dave, because he was on the road so much, you know, because he had five sons and one daughter.
Yeah.
And great family, close-knit. And so, but when I was playing with him, never once did he ever tell me to how to play. You know, he didn't say, like, try to play like Paul Desmond. I couldn't anyway if I wanted to.
Yeah.
I love Paul Desmond, but, you know, he never said play like this, play like that. He was just, but you do what you do.
Yeah. What did you learn from him over the years? Like, as far as, like, living your life and the way you approach jazz, what wisdom did he impart on you?
He was very professional, very straightforward, took care of himself on the road, kind of aloof, you know, but wasn't going out and partying every night, you know. It's like, man, I'm going to get my rest and come back to the hotel room, get some rest, you know. But also, one of the things that made a big impression on me, you know, when I'm up there and I'm playing the style that I play, people didn't know what to think of it, his audience, that is. So he's on the piano looking at me, smiling. And they're looking at him, look at me. So they say, oh, Jerry must play pretty good. Dave likes it. But if he was sitting there frowning or whatever, they might have said, geez, I guess, you know, this guy doesn't sound that good. So I think to myself, when you're on the bandstand, you can't look miserable.
Yeah.
You know, you have to look like, yeah, this is a gift to play music. Enjoy it.
Absolutely. So when you were on the world tour and you were playing 200 days a year, what was that like? Was it grueling? Was it gratifying? What kind of emotions would happen with something that hardcore?
You know, you just, the thing when you're on the road, you just have to live in the present. You can't think about, and it's a nice thing because, of course, this is pre-cell phone. Nobody calls you. You know, you don't watch, I'm not watching TV. It's like you're just living in the present.
Yeah.
But every day, it's pretty grueling in that because Dave played high-end concerts, like every day you'd get up, you know, and leave the hotel at 9, get to the airport, fly for 2 or 3 hours or, you know, sometimes 3-4 flights a day, you know, to get where you're going. And, and then you finally get there, you try to grab something to eat, you do a sound check, or usually go do the sound check, grab something to eat, play the concert, get up the next day and do the same thing.
Yeah.
So, it's just living in the present tense, you know, and also playing music, you know, listening to music when I had, you know, headphones, but also, you know, practicing in your head because you didn't have time to practice with your physical instruments, so you learn how to play mentally.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. So speaking of learning how to play, you've been educating since the early 80s. What pulled you into education?
Well, you know, if you can't play music, if there's not enough gigs to support yourself, then, you know, practicing it, teaching it, is the next best thing. You know, at least you're involved in it. And so it just came natural to me, especially when I moved back to Boston because it's such a student oriented town or city that every year you get older and you get wrinkles and your hair turns gray, but everybody else around you is the same age in their early 20s, you know?
Yeah. Who taught you the most about jazz?
I'd have to say the people I listened to. You know, I learned how to play playing along with records and listening to music. You know, that's what teaches you. as far as individuals go, you know, everybody I play with, my friends, my peers, my contemporaries, you know, when I play with them, we're talking this, we're talking that, we're playing this tune, I learned something from that tune, you know, that sort of thing. But mostly, when I grew up, there weren't any real jazz teachers. So play this, do this, practice that. Yeah, learn tunes, play along, you know, and listen to records and learn tunes. So you teach yourself. You teach yourself methods that you think might get you to the desired goal.
Yeah. What do you try to teach your students?
Well, I try to teach them all the things that I've learned in, harmonic techniques, melodic techniques, rhythmic techniques, sonic techniques, you know, with sound. But I try to teach them to believe in themselves, too, because the older you get, you realize that, hey, there's no one way to do this thing. Everybody's got a unique way.
Yeah, absolutely. Who would you consider your jazz heroes? You talk about, you know, you learned a lot from what you listened to. Who were some of the titans that were coming through your eardrums that you loved listening to that really had a profound impact on you?
Well, Sonny Rollins, Wayne Shorter, Joe Henderson, John Coltrane, Dexter Gordon, Hank Mobley, Stanley Tarantino, Sonny Stitt, Charlie Parker, Lester Young, Ben Webster. Those are tenor players.
Yeah.
Sonny Stitt, alto as well, but, you know, Charlie Parker, alto too. But, you know, alto players, Charlie Mariano, Lee Konitz, Cannonball, everybody.
Yeah.
Well, you know, listening to 1 week, I'm, you know, well, 6 months, I'm completely nuts about one player, and 6 months later, I'm nuts about another player. You know, you just go, it's like, and you get, and not only that, you get to see them all.
Yeah.
Roland Kirk. Yeah.
So you played with so many people over the years. Is there anybody that's kind of in your periscope right now that you would love to play with that you haven't over the years?
All the people that I've wanted to play with, most of them are gone, you know. And people ask me, well, who's your favorite player today? And I think, what's the last player I heard?
Yeah.
You know, it could be a student. It could be putting on a record. Oh, man, I can't believe that. You know, it could be somebody old. It could be somebody new. So when I was younger, I had an agenda. I wanted to sound this way, that way, this way, and learn this way. Today, it's not like that. It's like I just, you know, I'm more eclectic. But as far as wanting to play with somebody, it's like whoever I have the opportunity to play with, that's who I want to play with.
Yeah.
I don't try to, like, say, yeah, I really want to play with this guy because, you know, I'm going to get frustrated.
Yeah. Yeah. So in your life of creativity and in an artist's life, there's times where there's a real prolific growing period or a lot of things are getting created. Do you ever look back on your career and think, man, that time period right there, there was a lot going on, a lot of growth, a lot of things. Is there anything like that in your life?
Actually, I'd have to say no.
Yeah.
I don't live in the past. Like, whatever happened doesn't even seem like me.
Yeah.
So I said, yeah, man, I listened to your record. This, and I think, oh, yeah, and I'm courteous, of course, but to me it's not even me. Just like, yeah, that happened that day. That's what happened. Cool. But I don't take credit for it or it's, yeah, that's kind of like, you know, I'm in the present. This, I'm feeling what I'm thinking about today, not what happened 1 year ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a strange feeling. I feel detached about that. It doesn't feel like who I am today. It just
right.
feels like the weather of that period. So,
yeah.
Yeah, that's the weather of 1989. That's what the weather was like. But today, yeah. It's a different weather.
Yeah, absolutely. So So it seems to me, as an artist, the pinnacle of your life can be coming up with your own record label. When you established Not Fat Records, was that a huge moment for you?
That was a big moment, yeah, because nobody was recording. You know, you couldn't get arrested, never mind get a recording contract, playing jazz, that is, or creative music. So not only was the record label great for me, thank God for Bruce Gertz, who's still putting out records and has his own label, who was paramount in having this all work. But we used to go in the recording studio every 2 weeks,
yeah,
you know, and just play, not to necessarily have that come out on a record. And just listening to it, you learn so much because you're trying to make a statement. And a lot of times, the things that I thought, oh, I'm going to play this, so I'll try to play some of this stuff. Oh, God, that's, I don't like that. And the stuff that was just kind of off the cuff and natural, kind of liked more. So you augment what you like and diminish what you don't like. And it's a learning process. Recording, it's great school.
Yeah, absolutely. When you look back on your first gig, like really your first big performance in front of a crowd, and then think about today, how do you approach the stage today versus the way you did in the beginning? Do you get nervous? Do you just, I mean, is there a way that you approach it now that you're wiser and older versus in the beginning?
Yeah. You know, I can remember playing gigs where I look out in the audience and, you know, all my peers are there, Bob Berg, Mike Brecker, you know, so-and-so, and you know, you just try not to think about it. You just say, okay, I'm playing music.
Yeah.
And I feel like that today. And of course, playing with Dave Brubeck helped, because sometimes you're playing in Symphony Hall, Lincoln Center, Carnegie Hall. All the great halls throughout the world, and you just, after a while, it's just like there is no audience. It's just music.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I might be lame to say that, but, you know, the audience is a figment of your imagination.
Yeah. No, that's cool. What's the greatest thing about waking up every day for you?
Having a cup of coffee.
Amen.
No,
that's great.
You know, just getting up and having your mind clear, not cluttered. Like, you know, you get up and all that stuff that you have to do this, you have to do that. You know, when you get up, it's kind of just taking it easy. And it's kind of just trying to clear your mind, get rid of all, just be free.
Yeah.
Space.
Yeah. Right on. You know, when you look through the annals of jazz and you look at all the names that kind of surface to the top, kind of the perennial downbeat list, your name's up there. You're a big shot in jazz. And I know you're kind of an existentialist. You look at the future or you look at right now. Do you ever think, man, this is, it's cool that all these years have gone by and I've really accomplished a lot with this love of music, and you're a big shot in jazz. Does that ever kind of hit you that you really enjoy that, or is it just something that's not on the radar?
You know, I never think of myself as a big shot in jazz. I don't feel any different than the way I did when I first started playing. It's all the same to me. I shouldn't say this. I never read jazz magazines.
Yeah.
You know, because I'd rather read a novel or a car magazine or something like that. that's just because what I do, you know, so why read about it?
Yeah.
But I don't think of myself as that, and particularly because, you know, having... When you're traveling and you're trying to make a living on the road, it's not easy.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not like I'm on that level where, you know, I'm making a lot of money out there playing. It's not like that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm kind of an underground. Musicians know who I am, but the public doesn't know who I am.
Yeah.
So I just take what comes my way.
Right on.
So I don't think, I just live in the present.
Cool. What's left for you to accomplish?
Well, I have a couple of, you know, I write tunes all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, you can go on Jeff Elwood's site and download any one of my tunes for free. Just, there's about 300 of them.
Yeah.
And that's just half of them.
Yeah.
But so I'm writing all the time. I just want to, you know, play. I have a steady gig here Mondays. I had a steady gig Monday and Wednesday, but the Wednesday one is out for a while. And so we get to play all these new tunes every week. I'm putting new tunes in front of these musicians, and we're reading them down and playing them. So that's really a great opportunity for me in just to write and have it played by fine musicians.
Right on. Final question, how do you want the world to remember you?
You know, never thought about it.
Yeah.
I think to myself that, you know, people say, oh, yeah, I tell people music is the master. We're all students, you know. Yeah. So the world can think of all musicians as students to the super, you know, to the universe of music. I mean, it's just, we're just scratching the surface.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'd like to see the world think of me as a positive person.
Right. Jerry, it was a refreshing interview. I really appreciate you taking some time out, and continued success.
Thank you, Joe. All the
Take
best. Thank you for doing it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to yet another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in New York, Kansas City, Boston, and spots all over America, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to the great Jerry Bergonzi for his honesty and extreme cool. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Dimino on the iTunes Store, or you can always visit theneonjazz.blogspot.com for all things Neon Jazz. Until next time, enjoy the music, my friends.
Neon Jazz.